All right, so many of the catastrophic risks about which effective altruists concern themselves are likely to result from failure to control much smaller events, which then grow so large that they do become catastrophic. Our next speaker, Professor Mark Lipsitch, will just describe examples from infectious diseases, a paradigm case of a growing risk, and describe implications for the allocation of our attention, efforts, and funds. Mark is the professor of epidemiology and the director of the Center for Communicable Diseases Disease Dynamics at Harvard's Chan School of Public Health. He studies the impact of medical and public health interventions on pathogen populations and the resulting feedbacks for human health. Please help me welcome Mark to the stage.
Thank you, Roxanne, and thanks to all of you for attending and to the organizers for the invitation. This paper, I think, has had a large influence on the way many people in the effective altruism movement and beyond think about prioritizing their efforts. Because this article by Nick Bostrom and a whole line of thinking among people in this group is that dealing with truly existential risks involving potential extinction has enormous and possibly even infinite value. A consequence is that of that kind of thinking is that emphasis is placed on trying to prevent very rare events, because by definition, but in practice, small events, small hazards. This is a graph of flood size and against the frequency with which floods of different sizes happen. Small events are common and very catastrophic events are rare. And of course, extinction events so far have not happened to our species. And because effective altruism is a lot about prioritizing where to put funding and attention and effort of various sorts, including intellectual and scholarly effort, scientific effort, and implementation effort, it raises the question of where on this kind of scale from very unlikely but very terrible outcomes to the less bad but much more common outcomes that we also would like to prevent. And in going to a conference, attending a conference where people are talking about things ranging from cataract surgery to artificial intelligence catastrophes and many things in between, I think this whole spectrum is worth thinking about. I work on infectious diseases, and I want to make the case that at least in my field, and I will mostly limit my remarks to something I know something about, which is infectious diseases, at least in my field, this continuum is not just a place where we have to decide where to sit, but it's a continuum in which bad, really, really bad events, the worst events, infectious disease events of our species history, grow out of small events. And if that's true, and it's sort of almost by definition true for infectious diseases because they spread initially from one introduction into the human species, usually, almost always one introduction into the human species or a few, to sometimes affecting many, many people and more often affecting a smaller number of people. So it seems like almost a paradigm case of a risk in which really terrible things, really large-scale things can't happen if we can control smaller things that if let out of control, would get worse. And I want to make the pretty strong claim that if we're concerned about catastrophic and existential risk, which there are many reasons to be concerned about, and certainly many people in the room will have thought of all of these and be focused on catastrophic risks. But I want to make the claim that if we really care about catastrophic risks, at least in the field of infectious diseases, we should focus on controlling smaller risks. And people care about catastrophic risks for some of the reasons on this slide, which I won't reiterate to this audience. So the basic point is that in infectious diseases, it's very rarely the case that we have an event which has a big flashing red sign saying on it, this is a global catastrophic risk. That is not the typical situation. Infectious diseases always start as a small and difficult to interpret, often usually difficult to interpret thing. So on the left here is a slide of the initial report of the HIV epidemic. And it was an epidemic of 5 young men with pneumocystis pneumonia in Los Angeles. And a few years later, it was worked out that this was, and they were all gay men, and it was eventually worked out that they were immunocompromised due to human immunodeficiency virus, then called HTLV-3, and the world's attention became focused on this issue. But this was just a case report of 5 men with some unusual things in common, both in terms of their demographics and in terms of what was happening to them medically. But it was not; it did not announce itself as a global catastrophe, and indeed, the fact that it was in Los Angeles meant that it had already spread from its origins, from its African origins, and was widespread in the human population. But at the beginning of our recognition of it, it was one event of a rather small magnitude. The 2009 swine flu, which many of us will remember, emerged in La Gloria, Mexico, with 60% of the town's population sickened by a respiratory illness of unknown origin. It then, that was in February of 2009. By May of 2009, it had come to the attention of authorities nationwide in Mexico and in the United States. And it was still, as I'll show you in a minute, quite uncertain whether it was, whether this was a major catastrophe or a minor blip. And the Black Death, which is arguably the worst infectious disease epidemic in human history, started with, in terms of proportional impact on the population, started with spread from China and then led to, then moved across Asia and Europe in a rather gradual fashion due to the slow transport of the time. Even with pandemic influenza, and even when it's hit large-scale populations, there are often very small events that herald larger events. And there is, in fact, a term in influenza epidemiology, the herald wave, which describes the early wave of influenza in a new pandemic that that is sometimes quite modest in its impact. So I've circled in purple the herald wave in Copenhagen of the 1918-19 pandemic, which ultimately killed somewhere around 50 million people worldwide, with disproportionate impact on the poor and low health quality people with low access to health care, but dramatic impact in all the world's population. But in Copenhagen, where there were good records kept, and so these data can be extracted after the fact, only 5% of the total mortality happened in the early wave in the late in the spring and summer, and then the vast majority happened as in this country and elsewhere in the fall. We don't know whether that was a change in the virus, whether that was a change in in the conditions of the host population or something else, but this little blip was probably not something that would have concerned as many, very many people. And notably, that's happened in other pandemics as well. So this 1889 to 92 pandemic, which we don't know much about because there were the virus etiology was not understood at the time, but this early pandemic, which was almost certainly flu in 1889 to 92, started with a rather unimpressive blip of mortality here shown in London. And the 1968 pandemic of flu, the most recent one before 2009, also was what has been called smoldering for a year, and then it became it did much more of its damage a full year later. So I think that little historical episode dramatizes to me that one of the most important inputs into our thinking about infectious diseases is to remember what has happened in the past. And as in the era of big data and better surveillance and better and big computational models, it's often tempting to think we understand the latest situation based on the latest data. But what history has shown is also a guide to what can happen. And for example, just as an anecdote, it was imagined by many people in responding to the 2009 pandemic that we would be facing a big wave in January of 2010, because that's when normal flu seasons peak. But if you look at previous pandemic years, almost all of them peaked earlier in the fall because it was a new virus and it was more able to transmit at an earlier time. So that's just one example of learning something from history that was that this paper published early in the pandemic warned about, others of us warned about, but much of the planning forgot because it was too focused on the present. So I think history can be an enormously valuable guide and sometimes forgotten how valuable. One thing I think we should also remember, though, is that history is not always a great guide to what can't happen. So if you imagine yourself in the position of someone in say 2013 or early 2014, before the most recent Ebola epidemic that ravaged West Africa, three countries in West Africa, there had previously been, depending on how you count, over 24 small Ebola outbreaks in these countries. This is a map of the different outbreaks that had occurred in different African countries. Every single one of them had been controlled before it reached a size of 500 people or more. and most of them had been controlled at a size of maybe dozens to a couple of hundred. And I think I would have been among those who mistakenly said at the end of 2013 or the beginning of 2014, Ebola has been controlled 25 times. We have limited resources, and we can't do everything. And focusing on Ebola vaccination might be a reasonable thing to do if you're worried about bioterrorism, but is not a major global health priority. As you know, that turned out to be foolish reasoning. And retrospectively, one can understand various reasons why. It probably was a somewhat different situation given the countries that it was in, which had less experience and less health infrastructure than some others. But it's also just a fallacy of statistical reasoning. And one of my favorite papers in the medical literature is this old paper from the 80s called "If Nothing Goes Wrong, Is Everything All Right?" And it does a very simple calculation and points out that if we know that nothing has happened out of, say, 24 times, then, of course, our best estimate of the probability that something goes wrong, where by go wrong I mean the epidemic gets out of control, our best estimate should be that the probability is zero, because in the past the probability has been zero. But we have some uncertainty around that. And the uncertainty, if you take a 95% interval of uncertainty, as most people do in public health, the uncertainty extends from 0 up to 3 divided by n, where n is the number of times where nothing's happened. So 24 times, our estimate of the risk of a Ebola outbreak getting out of control, if all Ebola outbreaks were created equal, should have been that it's somewhere between 0 and 1 in 8. That's very different from 0. Right, 1 in 8 probability of something like what happened in West Africa a couple of years ago is something to the world community should be worried about. And so the point of this is that that history can tell us what is possible, but we should not make the fallacy of believing that because something has not yet happened, it is not possible. And again, in many other fields, I think that's obvious because of technological progress and the like, where the technology creates the risk. But because we tend to think that in infectious diseases, technology mitigates risks rather than creating them, which is only partially true, perhaps we get the feeling that if we've escaped these something terrible happening, we are safe, and I think that's a fallacy. So how do we deal with these small threats that might get large? The problem is really one of filtering. This is a screenshot from HealthMap, which is a project of Children's Hospital Boston that aggregates information mainly from ProMed mail, which is reports of outbreaks or suspicious infectious diseases or suspicious diseases of unknown cause that might be infectious in plants, animals, and people all around the world. And this is the week's alerts from 1 week. It's a little bit deceptive because the world is shown here twice, but blame Google for that. But if you just focus in on the world as we know it, there's a lot of alerts, right? And most of these, we're all going to be here in a few weeks, let's hope. And so most of these are not going to turn into major risks. But the problem of filtering and figuring out which of these many, many alerts is serious and which of them should get a lot of attention and which of them should get less attention is an unsolved one at the moment, although there's a lot of work and some progress. So it's not just that the way to prevent a big outbreak is to keep a small outbreak from growing, but it's also that big outbreaks of infectious diseases are more bad than they are than just the in proportion to their size. They're disproportionately bad. This is a picture of the setup that was arranged for the nurse that was infected with Ebola, and in New Jersey. And this is the line outside the Ebola treatment unit in one of the West African countries. And so the idea that you can devote resources like this to controlling one case is very different from from what you can do when you already have a large epidemic. So the local capacity is limited, and so keeping one person from transmitting is very different and easier than keeping many people from transmitting. An additional reason for that is that national and global outbreaks prevent mutual aid. So in a flood or a earthquake, the damage is localized, and so it's possible to bring in power line people and emergency responders and others to help from one unaffected region to an affected region. But as the scale grows, that kind of mutual aid breaks down because there are no unaffected areas or there are fewer unaffected areas. And then a really specific point about infectious diseases is that large pathogen populations, so more people infected with the pathogen, provide more opportunities for evolution to occur, meaning changes, genetic changes in the pathogen itself. Those evolutionary changes may not all be bad. They might make the virus, for example, more mild, but they might do the opposite, or they might lead to evolution of a novel way of transmitting. And that risk of evolution increases both because genetic variants that are rare are more likely if you have more viruses around or more pathogens around, and also because natural selection works more efficiently in large populations. So I mentioned that when the 2009 flu outbreak, flu pandemic began, it was very tricky to figure out what was going on, and I was quite involved in this effort, especially throughout the period. but just a few vignettes. So on May 4th, 2009, I was at the CDC in Atlanta where they had requested people to come and help them make sense of what was going on. And there were two seemingly really contradictory data points. I mean, there were others, but these were the two sort of things people were focused on. In Mexico, 4% of the approximately, I think it was about 500 cases of known pandemic flu had died. And that's twice the severity of 1918. 1918 killed about 2% of those infected. In the United States, there were 1,000 cases or so, one of whom had died, which is about the death rate from seasonal flu. Same area. So this presented a real question. This is maybe not a catastrophe, maybe it's certainly not an existential risk if it's 4%, but it is quite clearly a catastrophic risk. And this is the 1.1% is not a major increase over past. By July, it was still the case that people were publishing estimates of the case fatality risk, meaning the probability of dying if you're infected, that spanned 3.5 orders of magnitude from about 1% to down to 1 in 250,000. So we were really uncertain what was going on. So I think for me, the consequence of this, and ultimately, these much lower estimates turned out to be much more correct. And we can talk if people want about why it was so hard to figure it out. So for me, the consequence is that we should focus on trying to deal with this minefield of many, many small threats, some of which might get large, rather than trying to say, when something gets large, how are we going to deal with it, that catastrophic risk? So the best way to deal with infectious disease risks is never to let them get catastrophic. So in particular, that means for systems that we can't try to build systems that are only going to be activated in the event of a catastrophe. Those systems will atrophy, the people will be untrained, the people will be inexperienced, they won't know each other. And so, for example, this is a snapshot of the Emergency Operations Center at the CDC in Atlanta. And their website states that for more than 91% of the time in the last 7 years, this system has been activated. So there was pandemic flu, there was MERS, there was Ebola, there was some Zika, there are some headline things, and then there's some smaller emergencies. But they recognize that you don't set up this system and then leave it. You have to keep it being exercised. And that means that investing in the sort of more boring response to only subcatastrophic risks is an essential part of dealing with, of being ready for the more catastrophic ones. Other ways to channel this kind of effort is to try to speed the identification of and the focus of resources on the biggest threats. So as you saw, there are many, many little threats. Some of them will become big. And we still have an imperfect understanding of how to identify those, but better surveillance and especially better tools and forums to share data in outbreaks are really high on the agenda in my field right now. And this is a diagram from a paper that we wrote a couple of years ago about the sort of inputs from influenza from the sequence of the virus to the properties of the virus to the determinants of risk from that virus up to the decisions that we might make. One of the most useful documents I've read about thinking about risks is from a former Secretary of the Navy talking about national security, so completely different field, Richard Danzig. And his argument is that humans will try to predict things. It's in our nature. Bureaucracies like the military will even more try to predict things because there's an incentive to do so. But that smart planners will try to design countermeasures that are robust to being wrong about those predictions. In the infectious disease field, that means things other than very narrowly targeted vaccines or efforts to control one pathogen at a time. So there are things like surveillance, building public health capacity, investing in machinery that will help keep people alive, therapeutic drugs and devices that are targeted to the host rather than a specific pathogen, and other things. So I want to end by speculating a little bit about how much this might apply outside infectious diseases. And I want to bring in another sort of important article that from an effective altruism, from part of the effective altruism crowd, which is this article by Toby Ord and colleagues, which makes a very simple argument that if there is a very low probability, if you have a model, which we all use for low probability risks, and that model says that the probability of some risk is very materializing is very low, then the probability that that model is wrong could possibly exceed the probability of the risk predicted by the model. And so you should be more worried about this probability that the model is telling you something inaccurate than you should be by the estimated low risk. Applying that now to models of our own actions and of working to prevent catastrophic or existential risks, if we were infinitely knowledgeable, then work to prevent catastrophes that was only valuable for preventing catastrophes and did nobody any good if that catastrophe failed to materialize, might be infinitely valuable. But our models of our own actions and how those actions will reduce, we hope, or potentially not reduce, because the model might be wrong, the risk of catastrophes. We have to have a model of how our actions are going to affect that risk, and that model might be wrong. And for the lowest probability risks, the most catastrophic risks, our model predicting the impact of our actions is possibly more likely to be wrong than the risk is to materialize. So I would submit for people to debate whether this is another argument for emphasizing efforts against higher frequency subcatastrophic risks rather than focusing on what we think are efforts to mitigate very low probability risks. But since our models of how our actions will affect that risk must be uncertain, given the low probabilities, maybe we're wrong. So I will stop there and take some questions.
Basically ran out of time. It would start to squeak over into our break, I think, if we were to take questions, although you did get a few. So if people want to come up to you afterward, he'd be happy to take some questions. So thanks all for coming.